with Michelle O'Brien in the paper to abolish the family, the working class family, and gender liberation in capitalist development.
Okay. Hello, everyone. I'm very excited to be here. I guess I want to start off in thanking my other panelists, two of the more brilliant and inspiring intellectuals I've ever had the chance to meet, and Jules Gleason and Holly Lewis, for their role in really expanding the presence of queer and trans people here at the conference over the years, and especially this year. And the editorial collective at EndNotes, which has given me a lot of feedback on this paper. And lastly, Jules, who also gave a huge amount of feedback. Jules is there. Today I'm outlining a very long paper. It's over 30,000 words, and I actually have not tried to condense arguments into a 20-minute talk of that length. And it becomes really schematized, like what is hopefully an unfolding dialectical developmental logic in the argument becomes just a schema. And I'm going to just sketch the outline of that schema for you, and unfortunately all its interrelations are not as developed as I would like. Okay, so in the Communist Manifesto, Marx and Engels speak of the abolition of the family as the infamous proposal of the communists. The abolition of the family is haunted queer, feminist, communist struggles ever since, and proletarian movements offering an horizon for gender and sexual liberation. I came to this project through editing a reader of revolutionary feminist thought from around 1890 to 1980, and I saw over the course of it many people in various ways talking about the abolition of the family. But I slowly pieced together that what they meant by that was extremely contradictory, that what Marx meant actually didn't seem to match up at all to what Alexander Kollontai meant, for example, or struggles in the 1960s. And so I began to sort of create a taxonomy of the different ways that they were related, but then I saw a pattern. And so that's what I'm going to offer to you today. I found there is an unfolding historical logic that underlies the transformation of this slogan, and that this follows the moving contradiction of capital itself. So in each era, some form of the call to abolish the family reflected the furthest vision of gender and sexual liberation. The transformation of the meaning of this demand followed the transformation of working class family life, which makes sense. Specifically, I argue the rise and fall of the workers' movement produced a specific family form, the working class male breadwinner family. And we can parse debates about the family in terms of before, during, and after this period of the workers' movement. So the idea of the workers' movement is not universally agreed upon in socialist circles. It's quite a controversial idea. It comes out of Théorie Communiste and EndNotes, and that they argue that there was a specific phase of proletarian and communist struggle from 1890 to around the mid-1970s that encompassed all the major revolutionary tendencies and socialist movements of this era, including anarchists, syndicalists, councilists, left communists, Leninist forms of all sorts. And it was based on envisioning a social society as a workers' society, as the generalization of key features of life of industrial wage laborers, basing their movement on an affirmative workers' identity. This was not the abolition of class as proposed by Marx, and that since the crisis of the 1970s, producing a global contraction of the industrial working class, a crisis of capitalist profitability, and the massive growth of surplus populations all over the world, that this vision of a workers' society is no longer plausible to the vast majority of proletarians and struggles, and it calls on our current era to find a new basis for communist and proletarian movements. I found this framework extremely helpful for making sense of how the demand to abolish the family changed over time. So prior to the rise of the workers' movement, during the period that Marx and Engels are writing in, the demand to abolish the family meant the effort to destroy bourgeois society, recognizing the family as a fundamental tenet of bourgeois social order and property. During the workers' movement, from the 1890s to the 1970s, the upper tiers of working people were able to establish what had been inaccessible before, a male breadwinner nuclear family achieved by a tier of working class people, much like the bourgeoisie of previous eras. During this time, the call to abolish the family took two major forms. One was Kollontai's efforts to collectivize reproductive labor during the Russian Civil War, and queer and feminists and others revolting against suburban family life in the 1960s. Since the decline of the workers' movement, capitalist crisis has again transformed family life, making the male breadwinner family impossible for most working class people. So, to understand the first era and the meaning of the demand to abolish the family meant by Marx and Engels, let's go back to the manifesto. On what foundation is the present family, the bourgeois family, based? On capital, on private gain. In its completely developed form, the family exists only amongst the bourgeoisie. But this state of things finds its complement in the practical absence of the family among the proletarians and in public prostitution. Mm-hmm. The final point about public prostitution occupies a lot of my interest in the paper, but I'm unfortunately omitting that here. Instead, let's look at the first part of this quote. So in this first era, stretching from industrialization into the 1890s, prior to the rise of the workers' movement, and talking about Germany inland, mostly here, this was the period that Engels and Marx were theorizing. During this time, capitalism was indeed destroying peasant family life on a huge scale, moving people in cities, but paying them so little that they had a very hard time reproducing themselves. And there's a lot of evidence that in the mid-19th century, proletarians living in the major industrial centers of Europe were not generationally reproducing themselves successfully. They were dying much faster than they were able to raise children, and only the constant influx of peasants into the cities kept their numbers up. So this was very much a crisis of working class reproduction. Mm-hmm. And it made it extremely difficult. Many factors of people's lives, like children's employment, wage work in the home, lots of other things, made it very difficult to form stable family structures. Overcrowding, it's a long list. In Europe, this took the form Engels documented in The Condition of the English Working Class, where factory work by children, wage work in the home by mothers, and the condition of extreme poverty were destroying working class family. Marx and Engels don't talk about this that much, but in the Americas, there was another way capitalism was destroying a basis of working class family life, and that was enslavement. That slave plantations in the United States and Caribbean, capitalism was undermining working class family in a totally different way. Through the conditions of slavery, where subjugation as property made it impossible for enslaved black proletarians to build stable and enduring family structures. In this context, both in the Americas around slavery and in the crisis of wage worker life, industrial working class life, the call to abolish the family is not about transforming working class social relations at all, but instead a call to destroy bourgeois society, capitalist elite society, recognizing that the family was a fundamental plank of capitalist social order. Okay, however, a key feature of working class life began to change in the 1880s and 1890s for industrial workers. Driven by capitalist competition and a whole lot of factors I won't get into here, capitalist development and the rising organization of workers' struggle. In the 1890s, we see in Germany and inland the rise and institutionalization of a new workers' movement. This movement, in alliance with bourgeois reformers, won the material conditions for a new form of working class stability for the upper tiers of the workers' movement. They won the opportunity for a new characteristic family structure that belonged to the era of the workers' movement, modeled closely after the bourgeoisie they despised. a single male wage earner, an unwaged wife on whom all household reproductive labor fell, and their children enrolled in school. So we call this the male breadwinner nuclear family, the housewife nuclear family, the family wage family form. They're all the same thing here. The tenets of working class respectability became isolated housing, male domination within the home, and severing material dependencies on other families. So you see the emergence of this respectable layer of the working class that contrasts itself to the poor and lumpen proletariat. Meanwhile, and queers, right, and prostitutes, and lots of other deviants. Meanwhile, in the United States, with the defeat of Black Reconstruction, when some really interesting things happened with Black family structure, including lots of different forms of polyamory that I could talk about, sharecropping imposed an intensely brutal heterosexual family norm onto Black people. And there's been a lot of new research about this. Landlords required sharecroppers to marry before they could get access to land, and separating from their heterosexual relationship, they could bar them from being able to be sharecroppers anymore. And there weren't economic alternatives available to Black Americans than sharecropping. So Black marriage was enforced by the Jim Crow system. So in a bizarre way, we see the parallel of this respectable workers' movement, housewife-based nuclear family emerging in the upper tiers of the workers' movement, and simultaneously the enforcement of heterosexuality on the lower tiers of proletarian life in the United States. So I offer two quotes to illustrate the crazy contradictions and tensions that this family norm produced in the socialist movement. The first is from Karl Kautsky, key leader and theorist of the German SPD and Second International. He summarizes this newfound family conservatism of the socialist movement. One of the most widespread prejudices against socialism rests upon the notion that it proposes to abolish the family. No socialist has the remotest idea of abolishing the family, that is, legally and forcibly dissolving it. Only the grossest misrepresentation can fasten upon socialism any such tension. Okay, intention. In contrast, we can look to one of the major efforts to abolish the family during the era of the workers' movement that drew on another dimension of the workers' movement, which that was a vision of social equality through universal proletarianization. Mm-hmm. So the workers' movement really saw the universal entry into wage labor as the main path to social equality, which helps make sense a little bit of how bizarre it is that a movement that supposes wants to abolish wage labor tried to force everyone into wage labor. So Alexander Kollontai, during the Russian Revolutionary Civil War, did a huge amount around supporting the collectivization of reproductive labor through food canteens, childcare centers, seeking to eliminate altogether unwaged reproductive labor in the home. And this would introduce gender equality into the home, open on to the possibility of true love, now that no one is economically dependent on each other, and proletarianize all women into the workforce. There are many wonderful quotes that illustrate her thinking on this, but here is one. The individual household is dying. It is giving way in our society to collective housekeeping. In place of the old relationship between men and women, a new one is developing, a union of affection and comradeship, a union of two equal members of communist society, both of them free, both of them independent, and both of them workers. So this is very key, proletarianization as the basis of gender equality. Here we see the respectability of the male breadwinner family form in tension with this other tenet of the workers' movement around social equality through wage labor. So at the end of the workers' movement, the family form of the male breadwinner nuclear family in working class life came under direct assault by radical feminists, queers, and Black women organizing in the 1960s and early 1970s. They rebelled against a set of family norms and institutions exemplified by the suburban, heterosexual, isolated, patriarchal family form. through a series of struggles in gay liberation, women's liberation, welfare rights, and black power, they fought for greater sexual pleasure, gender freedom, and experimented with radically different chosen family forms. As an example, here's a quote from the Manifesto of Third World Gay Revolution. "We want the abolition of the institution of the bourgeois nuclear family. We believe that the bourgeois nuclear family perpetuates the false categories of homosexuality and heterosexuality by creating sex roles, sex definitions, and sexual exploitation." So here we really see sort of sexual identities as emerging out of this oppressive family structure. The crisis of profitability, overproduction, and surplus populations that brought an end to the workers' movement in the mid-1970s also brought an end to the working-class male breadwinner. Stagnant wages have made it increasingly impossible for any sector of the working class to raise a family on a single wage. And working-class people marry later, less often, or more likely to pursue queer relationships, co-parent in non-romantic relationships, or find other ways of surviving without the male breadwinner family. Yet this has come at a cost. The new universalization of the tyranny of the wage and the market in people's lives, the kind of dynamics of misogyny and abuse we're so familiar with in the workplace, and increasing atomization of private life. So recently, the demand to abolish the family has reemerged in some queer Marxist, trans-communist, and Marxist-feminist thinking. Rosa mentioned in the last panel, Kate and Jules co-wrote a brilliant essay about abolishing the family you all should read. And I, in a very recent piece that I was somewhat inspired by, a very concrete vision of communizing insurrection, a UK collective angry workers recently described the uprising and takeover of essential industries has to go hand in hand with the formation of domestic units comprising 200 to 250 people. Communal spaces, former hotels, schools, office blocks, etc., as central points for distribution, domestic work, and local decision-making. I love this. So new insurrectionary communist collective networks of reproduction, and a lot of this I think is voyeurist in a way that I'm really interested in, could in a revolutionary struggle replace the market, replace the family, and replace the state as a material basis for survival, and also an effective source of care, love, and erotic pleasure. Here, the positive supersession of the family, its abolition, is the preservation and emancipation of love and care that proletarian people have found with each other in the midst of hardship. The fun and joy of good sex, the intimacy of parenting and romance, freed from the rigid social codes of heteronormative gender and sexual identity, the material constraints of capitalism and proletarian life, and remade in the intensity of revolutionary struggle, the potential for love and care can finally be freed unto the world. The abolition of the family must be the positive creation of a society of generalized human care and queer love. So that's my talk. My whole argument that I thought was way too overwhelming, so I didn't organize the talk around it, but I have it as a slide, and I have it as a handout, so I'm going to hand that around, and when you're trying to make sense and remember this, maybe there's something there. And perhaps in the Q&A, there might be circumstances where bringing up that chart would make sense. I have 1.5 minutes left, so see dominant family form. We have bourgeois family, the male breadwinner nuclear family, and then in the current era, the diversification of family structures, but the nuclear family survives. Then various forms of capitalist undermining of working class family life, the crisis of working class social reproduction in the first part in the 19th century, the undermining of the normative family during the world wars, and the growth of white-collar employment opportunities for women from the 1920s on, but really accelerates in the 1960s and 70s. And then working-class male breadwinner family form becomes impossible. And then the communist vision of abolishing the family, the destruction of bourgeois family, and the war on bourgeois society, ending hypocritical monogamy, which they all talked a lot about. Ingalls and Fourier spend the most time collectivizing unwaged and then in during the era of the workers' movement, we have collectivizing unwaged reproductive labor, moving women into wage labor, and freeing them from the compulsory family as its abolition. And then radical feminists and queers seek to abolish the suburban isolated family unit towards gender and sexual liberation. And what family abolition means in our era, we have not yet discovered. Kate and Jules have gotten us halfway there, but I would argue that the previous formulations are not sufficient for our time, and we still need a new vision to emerge in the context of the aftermath of the workers' movement. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Now, Kate Doyle Griffiths, I'm presenting a paper on queer workers, social reproduction, and left strategy.
Okay. I know it's not the Q&A, but the 100 to 200 person family forum, it's very interesting. That's Dunbar's number, which I don't believe in at all, but is... You know, do you know it? It's proposed as the, like, you know, the natural limit for how many people you can know and how you're related to them.
Interesting. Anyway, I think of it as an apartment block.
Yeah. I mean, there's something to it. I don't know. Okay, so queer workers, social reproduction, and left strategy. And before I jump in on this, I just want to give you a few editorial introductory comments. The first is that I've been reading and writing about Mara Mielli a fair amount, so I'm using the words queer and trans here somewhat interchangeably, but I want to highlight that what that means is not queer as sort of generally papering over trans, but actually queerness as centered on and most profoundly expressed through transness in following Mielli. So that, and the second is I'm using the words socialism and communism, or socialist and communist, in much the same way, that they more or less mean the same thing to me, but maybe highlight a different moment of development or horizon, rather than being something that are counterposed or distinct. Okay, so that's the first thing. So it's the best of times, maybe, and the worst of times for a socialist movement, socialist left in the USA, at least in my lifetime. And I think there's a little bit of that in other parts of the world as well. But without going into a kind of state of the movement account, I want to say that I think this kind of moment has produced an environment for debate among socialists and communists where it seems like real advancements can and are being made in Marxism in general, Marxist feminism, and queer and trans Marxism in particular, and for their direct relevance to political strategies in a way that, at least to me, feels quite new. It feels like we're finally having some debates with real stakes. I don't like calling the sort of argument that I'm making here and that others are sort of queer or trans or even feminist Marxism on one level, because I feel that these are simply elaborations of Marxism made into useful tools of struggle, and want to get away from the sense that these are questions appropriately siloed in small rooms from, you know, away from the center of debate. It seems to me that we're making some real progress on this reality here, despite, you know, the obvious. One of the more vigorous debates lately has been about the theoretical and political approach that Marxist thinkers and organizers should take towards so-called identity politics in general, but toward queer politics in specific. Broadly, I think there are often assumed to be two camps in this debate, albeit with a range of nuances and some significant overlaps. And I think, interestingly, it's a debate that's beginning to draw in and inflect many of the historical oppositions around questions of left strategy. And I think it's actually probably best addressed in that register rather than at this kind of level of abstraction, or as if we're talking about something that's merely cultural. Often on the sort of class-only side of the debate, I think from that perspective, it tends to be imagined that there's an enemy camp One that I don't think actually exists, which at least not on the left, which advocates for and concerns itself largely with matters of representation or calculations of privilege. In particular, as the Democratic Socialists of America begins to approach the kind of triple digits in terms of thousands of members, and as its strategy and practice is being developed in the real world, one of the questions that has most interested me, and it strikes me as urgent, is overcoming this misdiagnosis and the significance of gender, sex, and sexuality for a new strategy for worker organizing. A queer Marxist feminist frame not only calls into question the divide between identity and class, but it also undermines, I think, some of the historical oppositions between, say, shop floor organizing inside or to win new unions and other strategies for worker and socialist organizing outside the workplace. In part, the debate about identity versus class politics has been crystallized around the publication of Asad Haider's book, Mistaken Identity, and a series of responses to it. The text points to the fruitlessness of a socialist class politics that poses itself against and in opposition to identity politics and calls for an insurgent universalism. The book has also been covered a lot this weekend, so I'm not going to say anything more specifically about it. I just want to frame us a little bit in that moment. Except that this paper is in some ways a response to some of his critics who, on the sort of right end of the socialist spectrum, have called for an anti-particularist social democratic program modeled on Kautsky and advanced with a strategy that simply, this is a quote, can't do both class politics and also any specifically anti-racist feminist or by implication, though it's not really mentioned, pro-trans or queer activity. On the left end of this critique, the same program is instead advanced through the tactical use of anti-racism and other direct confrontations with chauvinism in electoral and shop floor politics and motivated as a moral responsibility rather than a strategic necessity. So that's what I'm here to tell you is not right. Okay. The strategic necessity of organizing queer and trans workers and the political possibility of a deeper program implied by this is what I'm hoping here to kind of sketch out. Just as identity and class are a false dichotomy, so too, I think, are the oppositions between workplace organizing, affinity group models, and so-called community struggles. Probably electoral strategies, too, should be not counterposed to this, but that's going to have to be next year's paper. To take this up, I think we need to engage another book that's been much celebrated and feted this weekend. In fact, right now, that's going on. Kim Moody's On New Terrain. Elsewhere in Stoon, you're going to be able to read a very long essay I've written reflecting on the book and the rank and file strategy, but for this purpose I want to add to and elaborate on that argument and its queerest implications. In sum, that piece argues that Moody's updated analysis implies the importance of social reproduction theory for those now taking up the rank and file strategy today and introduces the necessity of analyzing a second category of choke point, adding on to Moody's focus on logistics, namely choke points of social reproduction. There I argue that the teacher strike wave concretely demonstrates that social reproduction choke points are right now central to a new wave of class struggle. Workers who are paid to do the work of the daily remaking of the working class in itself play a crucial role in expanding and politicizing workplace struggles and raising class demands that tend toward the universal. Precisely because workers in feminized reproductive sectors, and I just want to say my autocorrect kept changing feminized to demonized. a little weird. Okay. Like education are by definition in daily contact with a deepening crisis of care that impacts the entire class. The periodization of the recent history of class struggle and the model of its development that Moody maps is one that he presents actually as newly as complementary to a kind of Erigian frame. I argue that this is precisely lends itself to incorporating and validating Beverly Silver's analysis of the role of social reproduction struggles in public sector strikes at the early stages of periods of class upsurge or class uptilt over the last century plus. I then use Moody's formulation of transitional organizations to help break down dichotomies between workplace organizing and other modes, and to sketch out questions that Moody raised in a Jacobin piece concerning the undeveloped aspects of the rank and file strategy, most urgently of how it relates to socialist politics and organization. Rather than lay out the further details of that argument here, I'm going to add to it by explaining the role that I think queer workers place in this strategic elaboration. It's not actually enough to say that logistical and reproductive, logistical productive and reproductive, socially reproductive choke points are both each necessary and not sufficient on their own terms to express the power and breadth of any potential class for itself politics. A third element of strategy, I think, is crucial to this full development. Rather than stretch this choke point image too far, I think it's just simpler to say that socialists and communists must recognize and engage the uneven development of class consciousness with a recognition that its unevenness is rooted in experiences that are particular, but which at once both foreshadow and make possible the development of a class consciousness that goes beyond the politics of bread and butter to one of course, bread and roses. Roses here signifying a humane and insurgent response to and recognition of the deeper and universal alienations of working class exploitation, the length of the work week, for example, as a perpetual site of struggle, the experience of direct violent repression by the state and within the family, the embodied humiliations and alienations of working class subjectivity that are particularly crystallized in the experience of queer workers, but not, of course, limited to them. This is not distinct from what we've seen developing concretely in terms of the connection between feminist activity and workplace organizing. Rather, it's an intensification of this dynamic. From the strikes of thousands of workers at hotels and in the fast food industry sparked by the Me Too movement against sexual harassment and as a modality of labor control, to the recent Google walkouts against sexism and racism at work, to the developing generative interaction between teacher wildcatters in West Virginia with anti-Kavanaugh organizing and the grassroots struggle there against the statewide abortion ban. Queer and trans workers have the potential to intensify this connection between workplace organizing and class consciousness, between shop floor struggles, social movements, and class demands. To understand how, the first task I think is for us to locate queer people in the labor market and movement through a concerted effort of worker inquiry. So that's your task, all of you, homework. Okay. I think that kind of investigation will no doubt uncover unexpected and surprising connections. But even before that necessary work is complete, I want to hypothesize that queer and trans workers represent a dynamic and specific sliver of the working class, one that is vastly overrepresented in the work of paid social reproduction, particularly in the material organization of its expression as intellectual labor, and that maybe we can elaborate on this collectively. Okay, thanks. But also forge a link between this and the dynamism of the precarious and flexible family as a capitalist institution. While as a group, I think we present a politicized network that bridges each of these three nodes of strategic catalyzation. Here, maybe queers can demonstrate that the role of an affinity group can actually play in a broader left strategy, or instead be considered as a kind of vanguard in itself, one of several, but representing that potential as an actually existing social force, a basis of militant minority organizing across and between workplace and community, produced by and arrayed against sexual violence, reproductive authoritarianism, and the coercions of the family as forces that limit and damage working class people and which prevent barriers to the actualization of working class communist politics. In healthcare in particular, queers have historically played the role of politicizing healthcare access as class politics and of making political and organizational linkages between patients, providers, researchers, and specifically organizing to advance research agendas and test protocols formulated by working class people through our lived experience. The classic example of that is, of course, ACT UP, using direct action to demand care for HIV positive and AIDS affected people. But now I think trans healthcare can be seen as playing a similar and potentially politicized role. The particular role of queer people in making healthcare access into class politics over the last 40 years, at least, is especially important to highlight given that healthcare is often precisely raised as the archetypal Erfurt-style universal demand for the class reductionist left. From that perspective, illustrated by its advocates in the figure of the tragically closeted civil rights leader Bayard Rustin, queer and trans people, as well as disabled people and immigrants and so forth, any other category of people whose needs can be seen as particular and identity-based, represent an obstacle to the imagined negotiation with the ruling class for the adoption of this reform, an extra expense or distracting culture war set piece that disrupts and divides. But from an organizing and class struggle perspective, queers represent a reservoir of movement history, strategy, and experienced cadre for the healthcare struggle. At the level of consciousness, the demand by trans people for care raises the possibility of healthcare and all social reproductive struggle as a politics that refuses to separate self-fashioning from survival or to surrender to a one-size-fits-all profit-driven standard of what constitutes a bare minimum necessity. The lived experience of a small group of people recalls and exemplifies that original demand, central to the socialist or communist vision, that to each according to her need entails a recognition of our different individual and particular needs, and that the distinction between need and desire is as much an artificial product of capitalist logic as the division between politics and economy or between public and private. Further, queer and trans existence and class formation plays a crucial role in the development of an ongoing feminist wave as a working class project. While any given category of identity has its quislings and avatars of bourgeois representation, the lived reality of queer people brings to the fore gender as a relational and political process rather than a seemingly transparent and natural one. I can skip everything I'm going to say because Rosa said it last panel, but anyway, we make plain the absurdity of, say, Jordan Peterson's lobster-based naturalistic fallacy, but also the feminist version of that fallacy. The sort of thing that insists on a biologically reductive sex class as contra to a Marxist politics of social class and class as war. Our lives and experiences insert indeterminacy, both in the sense of compelling feminism to reckon with the possibility of actually existing non-binary forms of gender made livable through a combination of self-assertion and forms of community recognition and solidarity, and by proposing even binary genders as changeable across time. Queer people make visible in the world the crucial Marxian analytic move that what appears is often enough the opposite of what it is. Queer Marxist feminism in context marks and must insist at once on the particular liberation of individuals, and that liberation cannot reliably be embodied or represented by individual women moving on up in the world. When feminist women become bosses, they too are transformed across the span of a life and into something essentially different, anti-feminist in fact, if not in superficial form. Instead, our indeterminacy opens the possibility that core feminist demands, bodily autonomy and the freedom from regulating violence of the gendered ordering of paid work and family life, never only apply to one gender, and that they are not separate or to the side of class, but constitute how classes live for everyone. This sketch of an argument has very specific implications with respect to left strategies for resisting the right. This perspective is necessary for a class politics in general, and a communist politics in particular, that can go beyond the failures of a liberal approach to feminism and queer politics, which emphasizes diversity, inclusion, and tolerance, precisely because it raises the possibility of resistance to liberal cross-class co-optation and insists on, and because it distinguishes itself from reductionist invocations of class. Crucially, a queer Marxist lens also highlights how reductive engagements with class necessarily mirror and replicate liberal identity politics. Engaging class as a container or stand-in for other unmarked identities, whiteness, heterosexuality, cisgender masculinity, nationalist identities, are rooted really in demography rather than in any transformative building of a class for itself through struggle as a practice of solidarity and organization in and beyond the workplace. Back to Moody. Reading this through Moody highlights the material reason for the similarity. Just as liberal feminism and LGBT politics are attached to NGOs, through Moody the attachment of this class reductionist politics to bureaucratic layers of the labor movement is made plain. The most significant revision, then, to Moody's conception has to be rethinking his understanding of the role and root of transitional organizations. Coincidental name. Part of the explicit goal of these transitional organizations for Moody is to develop and cohere a minority of militants who are not only militant but political. Transitional organizations build concrete solidarity across all these things that we're just talking about and other divisions within the working class that are expressed as occupational and sectoral divides, but which are reinforced by chauvinist policies, attitudes, and harassment at the hands of the boss. The assumption here, it's been noted often by his critics, and there's some in the room, is a kind of stagist logic to radicalizing the working class, and particularly workers in its most organized and often most militant sectors, who can be among the more conservative sections of the class. Rather than viewing the working class as always already radicalized and for itself, and merely held back or restrained by a false and conservative leadership, the rank-and-file strategy assumes that the development of consciousness from trade union to class, and perhaps from class consciousness to a socialist one, or a communist one, as the projects of communists through the process of building concrete solidarity within overlapping layers of organization. Now you can see where my queer people are linking these things, right? With this horizon in mind, the rank and file strategy lays out why the unionized workforce is a crucial arena for socialist intervention, both on practical and political grounds, in ways that to me remain somewhat convincing, very convincing, and I think are compelling for are becoming more commonly talked about today because they're compelling for young socialists who want to commit themselves to a life of organizing and sustain themselves as an activist and militant without working on the basis of charitable grants, government funding, and who might wish to organize from and toward their own truly held beliefs rather than primarily as a paid staffer beholden to the agenda of their employer, whether that be a union, NGO, or government service provider. The original piece of the rank and file strategy is particularly sharp on the question of necessity of workplace action to lend to the achievement of even basic reforms, let alone the advancement toward socialism. In the context of the kind of community-heavy and particularistic 1990s, I think that inspired it was a little made in crucial point. But I think these days it must be especially pointed out that the rank and file strategy does not assert, and in fact it explicitly denies. Holy shit! Okay,
sorry.
That the workplace is the only or the most important source of worker consciousness, and that it's recognition that drives its vision of social movement unionism. And there's a long thing that I'm going to skip right there, but I just want to say, we can do it. Okay. A lengthy section of the piece roots the weaknesses of the USA workers' movement precisely in the history of African slavery and indigenous genocide, in building a working class historically divided against itself and often more mobilized in an explicitly political way around its own internal divisions than against capital. The piece saves space for a special interlude on the role of union bureaucracy as both a repository of some of the most backward historical forms of worker consciousness and as a break on militancy in moments of upsurge or even simply militant fight back. On its specific role as an engine of anti-communism, meant broadly as a purging of all leftists and radicals from the labor movement. It attempts to synthesize a non-sectarian assertion of the crucial role of socialists in, if not activating and potentiating, rank-and-file rebellion when the conditions become ripe, and elucidates a compelling set of historical examples that underlie both the urgency of this and some of the recurring obstacles to the full development of a consciousness and active class for itself. Not only a rearguard action by the bureaucracy, anti-communism, racism, and other chauvinisms, but also sectarianism among socialists broadly committed to the strategy. Queer and trans workers today represent, I think, one concrete way of reframing this concept of transitional organizations away from a coalition-based model, either on identity or nominally against it, and organized through bureaucratic alliances. And instead, it proposes and suggests transitional forms that organize the transition to a communist horizon along class lines rather than around them. The end.
Last year, Maya Gonzalez will talk entitled The Logic of Social Reproduction.
Yeah. First, I'd like to thank Jules and thank Leftovers for existing, and everyone who contributes to it saves my life some nights, and other nights it's just fun, but it's really important. So thanks for setting this up. I renamed my ridiculous title to The Logic of Social Reproduction because in the process of trying to write a kind of reconstruction of social reproduction theory and its history as a dissertation project, I hit a wall eventually. When I started looking at contract theory and the history of contract in the US in particular, and a lot of feminists, people using social reproduction in contract theory and legal studies. And I haven't really been able to go back and read social reproduction the same way anymore and not see all of these. And so finishing the dissertation, obviously, along its initial lines was impossible. But turning it around into a kind of loving critique of social reproduction theory, I thought that I would come here today and present that and criticize various different social reproduction theorists that are different. I realized that in all of the work that I've published or co-authored that exists, I reproduce basically all of the same problems, and so there's no point really in criticizing anyone else when I can criticize myself. And I can be a lot more brutal about it. But I'm really probably not. And this might not be the best talk, but I really, really like engaging people in questions. So, you know, bear with me here. I renamed the talk The Logic of Social Reproduction because I think that in the EndNotes article that I co-authored with a pen named Janine Nathan, I think that it was inappropriately titled and should be retitled if I could write it again differently, The Logic of Social Reproduction, because I think it does reproduce mm-hmm. the logic of social reproduction. That does not mean that it explains gender. I think the entire idea that there's a logic of gender is problematic as well, and so I'm going to start there and then work back. So in The Logic of Gender, I think that we deal with Butler briefly, and where we do, I think that this moment could be expanded to turn into an entire critique of the rest of it, actually. I'll try to explain why. So I'm going to read in full from The Logic of Gender. Sex, and forgive me if some of this sounds ridiculous, sex is the flip side of gender. Following Judith Butler, we criticize the gender-sex binary as found in feminist literature before 1990s. Butler demonstrates correctly that both sex and gender are socially constituted, and furthermore, that it is the socializing or pairing of gender with culture that has relegated sex to the natural pole of the binary culture nature divide. We argue similarly that there are binary social categories such which simultaneously denaturalize gender while naturalizing sex. For us, sex is the naturalization of gender's dual projection upon bodies, aggregating biological differences into discrete naturalized semblances. While Butler came to this conclusion through a critique of the existentialist ontology of the body, we came to it through an analogy with another social form, value. Value, like gender, necessitates its other natural, quote-unquote, pole, its concrete manifestation. Indeed, the dual relation between sex and gender as two sides of the same coin is analogous to the dual aspect of the commodity and the fetishism therein. As we explained above, every commodity, including labor power, is both a use value and an exchange value. The relation between commodities is a social relation between things and a material relation between people. Following this analogy, sex is the material body which, as use value to exchange value, attaches itself to gender. The gender fetish is a social relation which acts upon these bodies so that it appears as a natural characteristic of the bodies themselves. While gender is the abstraction of sexual difference from all of its concrete characteristics, that abstraction transforms and determines the body to which it is attached. Just as the real abstraction of value transforms the material body of the commodity. Gender and sex combined give those inscribed within them a natural semblance with a phantom-like objectivity, as if the social content of gender was, quote-unquote, written upon the skin of concrete individuals, like exchange value. The transhistoricization of sex is homologous to a foreshortened critique of Capital, which contends that use value is transhistorical rather than historically specific to capitalism. Here, use value is thought to be that which positively remains after revolution. which is seen as freeing use value from the integument of exchange value. In terms of our analogy with sex and gender, we would go one step further to say that both sex and gender are historically determined. Woo. Both are entirely social and can only be abolished together, just as exchange value and use value will both have to be abolished in the process of communization. Where we write that there is a foreshortened critique of capitalism, which demonstrates in form the way in which the market denaturalizes gender and at once renaturalizes sex, as the result of the generalization of the commodity relation and the domination of the value form, taking in spirit from Poston, which is what we had in mind at the time, we argue that use value is fetishized and naturalized, while abstract labor and exchange value taken to constitute the social form itself as that which is to be abolished, leaves one remainder, the material integument of concrete labor, transhistoricized. I argue that this is a general tendency within social reproduction theory, which in its earlier iterations sought to denaturalize domestic labor, unwaged labor, as gendered, while renaturalizing the concrete useful activities formerly considered the biological destiny of workers, of women, and therefore inadvertently preserve the capitalist sexual division of labor at as a cross-historical or pre-commodified basis of concrete useful reproductive activities. Extra necessary activities then become the apparent material basis of sexual differentiation and the binary division, sexual division of labor, thought to be built upon a contradiction between social labor and biology. Therefore, the concrete labor of social reproduction is infinitely deferred as its of its sociality, and can instead be that which is redistributed under socialism, not according to gender and sex, of course, but in a more egalitarian manner than traditional socialism's understood, within its limited framework of the socialization of necessary labor. So expanding the socialist and Marxist, in Marx's own political work, the idea that all class societies are a relationship between necessary labor and surplus labor, and that the necessary labor is the positive basis of its reorganization under socialism. And what social reproduction theory does, and I think in a really important intervention, is completely blasts that category of necessary labor open, so that we can never think about any activity within a society as being defined by capitalism as the basis of what we would be taking as necessary under socialism. So I thought that that's good, but... Anyway, therefore, these divisions are not thought to be produced by the social relations of the commodity form, historically specific to capitalism. So what we have is an extra necessary labor, which is transhistoricized as necessary labor also was, as something that must be done eternally and is devalued under capitalism. It devalues those people who do it, often women of color and poor, and that's the social form of domination over what would otherwise be a kind of natural necessity and necessary labor. Therefore, these divisions are not only thought to be produced by the social relations of commodity form, historically specific to capital, though we, in the logic of gender, say that gender exploitation arises from a contradiction within the commodity between use value and exchange value, We nevertheless do this with respect to a commodity, labor power, which isn't produced as a commodity and therefore has no inherent contradiction enfolding within its process of reproduction. In the reproduction of labor power, the contradiction specific to the commodity form is suspended and theoretically stitched back together. We explain that there is a contradiction between use values, which are produced outside of the social division of labor in the indirectly market-mediated sphere, adjacent to the market, but nevertheless determined by it, and exchange value is that which comprises the wage. And following suit, exchange value, as that which is gendered, is abstracted, while its mutually constitutive category, use value, or sex, is renaturalized as the very basis of life to organize under socialism, communization, precisely because it escapes this contradiction, it can be purified and naturalized. While social reproduction theory historically was an attempt to apply Marx's critique of political economy to domestic unwaged activities in order to visibilize exploitation and oppression across the total division of labor, this was a critical intervention made by International Wages for Housework movement. We no longer have that same justification for foreshortening our critique. However, it is not for lack of politics, but because there is something about the appearance of the world in its ongoing reproduction as a form that foreshortens and limits our attempts to comprehend the oppression of particular subjects. If we expand Butler's critique to social reproduction theory and therefore the bulwark of the argument of logic of gender, we find that it is based upon the same, well, it's not Butler, it's me doing Butler, so. While circumventing the question of what constitutes the subject itself, so we still have this problem, I want to argue that this is because the analysis of sex and gender and the logic of gender is an iteration of social reproduction theory caught within an ontology of the reproduction of labor power. Moreover, this, I wager, is because it takes the commodity relation and its production to be the formal analysis of the reproduction of labor power as a commodity. Later, labor power is exceptional, however, so exceptional to the reproduction of other commodities that it needs to be grounded in another analytic, suggesting that of the reproduction of the juridical form of value, the contract, and the property relations adequate to the circulation and exchange of commodities, not by property and between property, but the bearers of that property. Since labor power is only a commodity insofar as it exchanged with the value form in the form of wages, so I'm saying that that is what constitutes it as a commodity, the reproduction of its useful concrete character finds its analog not in commodity production, rather, I think, more along the lines of land and rent. This is something I'd love to have an argument about. I'm not sure about it. Wages are a title on a worker's specific concrete skills for a specified amount of time. That is its use value and exchange value characteristics, respectively. But like the landowner and the owner of labor power, has a commodity that is valuable insofar as it's concretely differentiated from other labor within the concrete division of labor. It is differential, and the rent upon it is also differentially constituted according to demand. We can argue about that later. However, the definition we find in Capital and reproduced in social reproduction theory naturalizes the use value and concrete definition of labor power precisely when it is defined in its most abstract. And so I'm thinking of the way Marx defines labor power very early on as human brains, nerves, and muscles. And I think that the moment we see human, we immediately have to be pay attention to the juridical definition of what a human is, and that immediately that word, what is a brain, a human brain, a human muscle, a human nerve, is not in any way kind of transhistorical, but absolutely even more historical than probably other, because it's legal, that is subject to change even within this mode of production. And I especially found this problematic when I was studying the history of slavery in the U.S., trying to respond to Angela Davis from the perspective of Lotta Feminista, and that the contract, like what is specified as brains, nerves, and muscles, when you look at the range of modern contracts for labor, which are not just wage labor, but also marriage is a labor contract, the servant contract, the slave contract, are all variations on the labor contract that I think mutually constitute one another. And the wage labor contract cannot exist without its other contracts. So we could think of the, say, something like housewife contract, rather than thinking of the work on the worker and as a producer. But if you look at the way in which, and this is, if you look at the history, the way in which the brains, nerves, and muscles of someone's wife is sold in a contract, they're doing wage labor tasks, selling labor power for and to produce value in the same manner in which, you know, the universal proletarian in Capital does. However, it's not every kind of brains, nerves, and muscles. These contracts, if one is selling one's wife's labor power, there, it's a very specific kinds, while certain reproductive aspects of, say, labor power, brains, nerves, and muscles, might be used and owned by one person in order to determine what the definition and content and use value of these brains, nerves, and muscles for a capitalist have to be very specific, and they do not cross over, whereas in a slave contract for female slaves, it was, you could say, both, where the brains, nerves, and muscles, and they're defined in differently than a male slave. Which brains, nerves, and muscles are very specific, and once we start looking back at contract now, we can see that labor power is a very, it's not universal, it's in fact, it's incredibly particular, and that it's defined by contract and subject to change. Wow. So, I think, let me just, I think that contractual relations or property relations adequate to commodity exchange generally and labor relations in particular should ground the analysis of labor power and its reproduction. This is what I imagined by having a solution to both debates over domestic labor and the question of dual intersectional or single system based systems based upon class, the latter. Even if we are to say that the class relation is primary and differential class relations are secondary, both are mutually constitutive of the juridical form of capitalist property based upon separation from the means of reproduction and market dependence. Both are conditions of possibility for the social form of value, although we can say, of course, that all proletarians are dispossessed of capitalist private property. By definition, they are not all equally proletarians. They are gendered, racialized, ethnically divided, differentially human, able, rational, or citizen. And most importantly, all proletarian subjects are proletarian subjects, right? Mm-hmm. This is a conceptual category, right? The class subject are defined by the property that they own in their person, their labor power, and yet paradoxically, not all those who labor historically own their labor power, that is to say, whether or not they share equal freedom. After all, some subjects own their labor power only indirectly, and some are often owned themselves. There is, you might say, a spectrum of juridically inscribed subjects of property who are nonetheless equally required to reproduce capital value. Some proletarian subjects are constituted by what Marx called double freedom, and others are constituted negatively by the lack thereof. Moreover, these are constitutive juridical freedoms that together mutually constitute the historical specificity of the modern wage-labor relation. All production and reproduction presupposes an asymmetrical axis of differential property and the differential right to appropriate it. And these two juridical relations presuppose the production and reproduction of all commodities, all value, and all capital. In sum, juridical discourse neither constitutes another system, nor is it secondary to material reproduction. If indeed we might consider the juridical form ideological, we must also admit it is deeply structural and certainly no more social or less real than any other category of abstraction.